an absolute gem of a human being and somebody I respect dearly. And I cannot wait to hear this message. I give you George S.
Where are we going? No. You ain't coming to Boston, I'll tell you that. I'm an alcoholic whose name is George.
Hi, George!
But Sunday school teacher was never going to be in there. It is now. You know? Mysterious stuff happens when you're willing to change your perspective and look at things with a new pair of glasses. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. It gave me a new pair of eyes to look at my life, to look at my place in the world. And the one thing I have to say every time I speak is that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. And anybody can get up here and talk and say that they do things, you know. But there are men and women in this room that I've known, some of you, for 30 years. This always happens. The gate comes out. You know? You know, I just went to you got some competition there. Way to go. There you go. So, you know, I found that, you know, I found that Alcoholics Anonymous is a place that treasures me for what I bring to the table and accepts me for what I can't. If you're able to do service at the area level, do service at the area level. If you think that that's just for strictly for like geeks and crazy people, then, you know, do the chairs. And if you don't want to do the chairs, then say hello to newcomers. If you don't want to say hello to newcomers and go to conventions, you know, I mean, if you can't find somebody to do an Alcoholics Anonymous, you ain't looking, you know. And I also want to mention that my first, I was 19 when I got sober, and I was surrounded by a few people that were my age, and they were going to this thing called Equipa. You know, they were going to all these conventions and conferences, and they were coming back telling me about all these great things. Oh, it was awesome. Everybody was wearing tie-dye t-shirts and had these big, giant, fuzzy slippers, and they had these big balls of yarn around the neck. But what? You know, do they sell flowers in airports? What the hell? You know, I mean, what is this? And they were playing like Bob Dylan songs and guitars in the lobby. I'm like, no, I don't do Bob Dylan. You know, so many things about this sounded so shady. I was just not ready for all the stuff. And year after year, my friends and my sponsors kept coming back and telling me about these conventions. And in 1987, I was 6 years sober, and Nicky Bar came to Boston. And what can I say now? It's in my backyard, you know. So I got together and I went to my first Young People's Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 26 years old, and I'll tell you, I haven't looked back. You know, I go to a lot of these. A lot of you know me, you see me at a lot of these, because this is the energy that I was looking for in all those illicit substances and in all those bars and in all those back alleys and in all those bathrooms. This is what I was looking for. I was looking for this love, this energy, this compassion, this caring. And I found it in Alcoholics Anonymous, but especially in young people's AA and in conventions. You know, and the love here is palpable. And it has its, you know, like anything else, there's a little bit of, you know, balance. There's a little kookiness, you know. But it all works out in the end as far as I'm concerned. If the love is there, nothing can break it. And I find the love here. You know, and I have souvenir tattoos from a ton of conventions, you know, and I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love Young People's. I continue to sponsor Young People's, Young People in Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't go to Young People's meetings because you kids drive me nuts with your, you know, and the dances and stuff. You know, you and your EDM and your give me some Madonna. If you're not gonna give me Madonna, I'm gonna go home. You know. But, you know, I can sit at that dance and I can look out on the dance floor and I can watch the love and the feeling and the passion and the energy that saves people's lives. Because, what, like I said at the very beginning, what we're selling here is hope. Not freedom from death. Not, you know, a way out of hell. Not like a way to, you know, to not die. Because we could have got that. You know, that's not really what we're selling. What we're selling is hope and a life that's second to none. And there's a ton of promises in that book. And I'll tell you that they've come true in my life. And they come true in ways that are just unimaginable. I love Alcoholics Anonymous more than anything. And I practice that. You know, gratitude is a great thing to say at a podium, but it comes out in my actions. You know, my gratitude shows when I take action in here. And if you're wondering what action you can take, just talk to a sponsor, find a group, find most people. Don't look for people that make you comfortable. Don't look for people that are like you. I find that usually to be a mistake. Look for people that are doing the thing that you know inside your heart is right and that you know inside your heart is good. Because if you follow people that are cool and that are comfortable and that are like you, that doesn't always work out in my experience. So I follow people that seem to have that magic thing that inside me, because inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. I'm not afraid of that word anymore, so if you don't like it, I don't care. It means something totally different to me. If you knew, you'd probably throw up, but you know, it doesn't matter. But inside every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God, whatever that means to you, and you know when someone has what you want. You know it. Even when you're brand new, 2 days sober, you know it. 1 day sober, you know it. You know the people that are doing the deal here. Find them, follow them, do what they say, because obedience is probably the best thing to pray for when you're new, in my book, you know. And I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love young people's. And I don't know really what else to say other than I came into Alcoholics Anonymous a subhuman who hid from the daylight, who never felt like love was even a possibility. I didn't know what the words meant. I was an alien dropped off here for an experiment. I was not a real person. And what I found here is the stuff that I used to read about in books and stories, you know, the kind of love that families are supposed to have, I found here. And I'm very, very grateful for Alcoholics Anonymous. And if anyone in the room, I mean, if you're new, there's tons of people going to talk to you, so you're good. But if you've been around Alcoholics Anonymous for a while and you still sometimes think about jumping off a bridge or putting a gun in your mouth, well, you still feel like, is that all there is? You know, you get that emptiness, that darkness starting to creep back in. Talk to somebody right now. Talk to someone tonight before you leave here. You know, and one of the greatest signs that AA is working for me is when I see someone who has 20 years of sobriety asking a man with 5 years to be a sponsor. My current sponsor has 5 years clean, five, because he has something that I want, and he helps me in ways that a lot of other people can't. It has nothing to do with humility, it has nothing to do with time, it has to do with that love and compassion, that transmission line of one alcoholic to another. So reach out to each other, help each other, love each other, because you might be the only person that can reach that person in the seat next to you, and without you, they might die. So never say no, and thank you for my life.
Thank you, George. Wow. Wow.
That never gets old. I get old, but that never gets old. Grateful to be here today and to share a message of hope. You know, I attend a lot of Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, and I talk to a lot of newcomers. I work in the field of mental illness and substance abuse treatment, and I hear a lot of people talking about how they have to get this because they're going to die. They have to get this because they don't want to live this way anymore. They have to get this because they don't want to go back to the way they were living. And I've never met one of those people that was able to stay sober based on that. I think we already know that we have a history of pain. What we need to know is that we have a future of hope, and that there's a place where the pain might just be relieved. If there's even a small chance, even if there's a little crack of willingness, there might be hope. So what I like to try to offer when I speak is hope. So I'll try not to focus too much on the story, but I tell my story because the only way that I got hope, I have, when I was 16, I had my first intervention, professional intervention, where people sat down and showed me a super 8mm movie about alcoholism. So there's a clue how old I am. Beta, I think Betamax just came out, but they couldn't afford it yet, you know. And so I saw this movie about alcoholism, and had a bunch of people with things, you know, with initials after their name, telling me that I should do this and do that and consider this and consider that, and that didn't work for me. And I also had two very loving parents who told me that that they loved me unconditionally and that I always had a home to go to. If I was willing to stop doing the things I was doing, I had a few friends left. I had a lot of people that were there for me. But that didn't help me. Because these were loving, beautiful, normal children of God. And I was not any of those things. And wasn't until I got to my very first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that I heard people talking. And I could believe what they were telling me. Because I identified. It was not the voice coming down from above. It was the voice coming at me from a place of experience. Because I can spot one of us. In a dark room, I could spot one of us. I can smell us. You know? It's like there's no signal, no signs, no secret handshakes needed. I can spot an alky in any room, any place, anytime. And because then I got to know where to get my signs, so I got to know who you are, you know. And so I can see us. I know who we are. And I could tell that these people that I heard at these meetings were telling the truth. They were telling the truth that they were like me, that they understood that pain, that darkness, all that stuff that I had inside. But all of a sudden, here they were with a different message, with a different way of life. And that's what made it attractive, and that's what made it click. Honestly, it never clicked when it was coming from someone who wasn't one of us. But when it comes from one of you, it comes from a very, very different place. So to get to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I'll tell you where I started drinking. I'm from Boston, in case you can't tell. I grew up in a little neighborhood in Boston. Boston's divided into these little neighborhoods, and it's a pretty kind of thing in Boston where you kind of live in a neighborhood and you don't really kick around the same like four blocks your entire life. It's really hard to escape, you know. And I grew up in this little, like crunchy little artist, queer community, you know, Jamaica Plain, and it was pretty cool, and, you know, it was nice, it was very cool and stuff, and I stayed in the same neighborhood, my whole family was from there. I come from a family of, my mom had 9 brothers and sisters, my father had 12, and none of us ever owned a car, no one ever learned how to drive, because we, you know, you live in the city. So I grew up in Jamaica Plain, And my parents don't drink. Neither one of my parents drank alcohol. They worked for a distillery plant. So they had tons of booze in the house because they got all this free stuff. But they didn't drink themselves. I found out later, in my 20s, I found out why my parents didn't drink. It's because there's alcoholism in my family that I didn't know about. Lots of secrets in my family. I found out all kinds of shit when I got older. But I didn't know that there was alcoholism in my family, so it was kind of there, but I didn't see it. So I grew up in a house where there was love and safety and attention. I was an only child, so I had all the attention in the world, and everything was great. Until I got to be that age where you're supposed to start leaving your mom and dad's house and going out and making friends and meeting people and doing things like playing sports and going to dances and joining Cub Scouts and all that other stuff. And I found that all of those things invoked an absolute sense of fear in me. I was cool sitting at home with my mom and Speed Racer. I was cool. You know, television was okay. But going out with other people was a real difficult thing. I had a lot of fear around it. And my parents pushed me out of the house, and I had to go out and start making friends and meeting people, and I failed. I wasn't able to do it. I was that weird, awful, geeky kid that had no friends, and I just, you know, had cooties and picked my nose and stayed home. I didn't go out anywhere. I just was terrified of everybody, you know. And And then high school came around. I was, you know, and in Boston at that time, there was this thing called busing where they were taking people from some neighborhoods and putting them on buses to send them to other neighborhoods. So it was a balance of, you know, of racial attendance at meeting at school. So I got, the option I had was to get bused to a neighborhood where there was a lot of violence and a lot of problems. And my parents decided that they didn't want me to have, they wanted me to stay safe and they wanted me to have, you know, a safe environment to go to school in. So they sent me to a Catholic school, an all-boys Catholic school. Because nothing bad ever happens at all-boys Catholic schools. They, you know, didn't do the homework. And I got sent to a school that was located in downtown Boston. Again, my parents never saw the school. Sight unseen, they coughed up the money and sent me to this school, not knowing that it was in the middle of what was then known as the combat zone of Boston. Most towns have one. Here you call it Times Square. But yes, you got it. 300 Tremont Street, Don Bosco. So I got out of the subway station at Chinatown Station. I walked past the Naked Eye Cabaret, the 2 o'clock lounge, the Silver Slipper, Good Time Charlie's, couple of head shops, you know, couple of, you know, porn theaters, a couple of peep shows, you know, and that was, and then I got to school, you know. So I learned a lot in high school before I ever got into the door. And it got really, I was terrified. I was really scared and I didn't know what to do. And I heard a lot of kids talk about drinking. And I hadn't had much experience with alcohol yet. I had taken a couple of sips out of drinks during that time, you know, before that. And so I knew what alcohol was. I knew that adults drank it and I tasted it a couple times. But I never had a full on like guzzle. And I heard these kids talking about drinking. And I remembered that I had all this booze at the house that no one was using. It was just collecting dust in my parents' pantry. So I went up and I grabbed a couple of bottles of that and I stuck it in my book bag and I brought it to school to see if maybe it would make me popular, make people like me. It worked. And we started drinking after school in the parking lot. And alcohol did something very, very different for me than it did for the rest of my classmates. I knew it right from the very beginning. It did something very, very different for me. I once said at a convention that alcohol did for me what spinning around in circles did for Wonder Woman. You know, it just made me into a whole nother person and all these great things happened. And all of a sudden those TV shows that I liked were much more interesting and I found I could actually have a whole conversation with you about things I knew nothing about. And wonderful things happened and I continued to drink. And I noticed right away that other kids from school would come back to school on Monday and brag about how drunk they got and all the things they did and they threw up and this and that. And I was ashamed of those things. I didn't brag about those things like the other kids did. And I knew something was different. I knew something was wrong. And by my junior year of high school, everything had changed. And I can't tell you where the progression started, but it didn't take long. It was very, very quick for me. I was drinking without my permission as a sophomore in high school. And I exchanged all of my friends from school, you know, the good little Catholic boys, I exchanged them from the boys in the park across the street in the Boston Commons, the homeless kids, the runaways, the drug dealers, and the prostitutes. And I made a very conscious decision to do exactly what I was told to do in one of my favorite songs of the time. I took a walk on the wild side. And once again, it was popularity, it was power, because when there was something finally that I could do that made me cool, that made me like everybody else, and that's what drinking was for me. And at that time, it was also the mid-70s, and disco was really big, I donned my little polyester pants and my platform shoes and tipped out to the local dancing spots and, you know, busted my move. And most of the other kids in school were doing the same thing. They were going to slightly different establishments than I was. All the other kids from school needed a fake ID. All I needed was tight pants. That was good. And my junior year of high school, I got invited to a party, a New Year's Eve party at my school with a bunch of juniors and seniors. So I went to this New Year's Eve party, and it was all the popular kids at school, and I was kind of nervous and kind of scared, and I didn't know what was going to happen, and I knew I had to bring something, so I bought a bottle of Seagram 7. I could buy booze when I was 12 years old. I've had gray hair since I was 12. I could buy booze anywhere, anytime. I can get into any club. And so I bought a bottle of Seagram 7 to this party, and I got there, and there was already a couple of bottles of Seagram 7 on the table, so they didn't need mine. So I took it, went to the corner, and I drank it. And I threw up all over everybody, and you know, I embarrassed myself. The guy throwing the party was a senior, and his older sister was helping with the party, and I grabbed her butt, you know. And that might not sound like a real jackpot to you, but I'm gay, so that's selling for less from a very early age. And it just got, you know, it just went, got worse from there, and you know, and then I found out that, you know, I was 16 years old, and going to some of these clubs and bars, and there were all these really nice older gentlemen who had lots of money and were willing to buy me things. I learned about the barter system. And that soon extended from alcohol to other stuff. And I started finding out that there were men that were willing to take me to places like New York and Connecticut and Rhode Island. And I got to stay in really nice hotels sometimes. And I thought I was living high. I thought this was the life. This is what everyone wants to do. I had no idea the price I was going to have to pay. And I paid with all my dignity. Threw it at people to get high and to get drunk. And I got back to, I'll get back to my story. Drinking led me to that incomprehensible demoralization that we hear about. And pain and darkness and suicide attempts and emergency room visits and police stations and sleeping in boxes under highways and in doorways and breaking into your house to sleep in your basement because the warm spot was right next to the boiler. And all these things I learned from my friends, the prostitutes and the homeless people and the drug dealers and the street people. I don't think I talked to my parents for 2 years before I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't even know what was going on in their lives. They didn't know where I was, and I didn't know what was going on with them. I wasn't, never felt like I could ever go home. And on the 4th of July of 1980, I'll rush this along, I went out with a bunch of people on a cruise. It was a little cruise around Boston Harbor, those little Gilligan's Island deals, and it was a gay disco cruise. Very fabulous. Feathers, sequins, bugle beats, wonderful. And we all gathered together, and we all had, like, you know, I had all, you know, one person got the mezcal and the other person got this Christmas tree, the other one got the purple micro dot. We put them all together and we had a party on the boat, and we got back to the dock, and we were all so messed up we couldn't even stand, it might have something to do with the high heels, but another boat pulled up, and the next boat was a classic rock cruise. So that was a slightly different crowd than the one that I was on. And there was just a little bit of a clash when the two boats came off at the same time. And I have a very big mouth. I always pick the fight with the biggest guy. I say the rudest, nastiest things that I can, and I throw myself in your face so that you'll not like me, because then I don't have to worry about whether you like me or not. I know you won't, because I can't say the word, but I'm a horrible person. And I got really, really badly beaten up. And I wound up once again in the emergency room. I found out that in emergency rooms, we're known as gomers. Get out of my emergency room. And I was a regular gomer at Mass General, I had to leave before they could do all the stitches and take all the glass out of my head. I had to, because it was last call, and I had to get to the bar. And I went to the bar, and I drank. And instead of letting them sew my tendons back together and take the beer bottle glass out of my scalp, I went back to the emergency. I went back to the bar and continued to drink. And the next day, I woke up on a bartender's sofa, not the first time. And a couple days later, My mom reached me. A lot of my friends had told my mom that I was having a real bad time, and my mom and dad invited me to come back home as long as I didn't do other stuff. They didn't say anything about the drinking. They just didn't want me doing that other stuff, you know, the non-conference approved stuff. And and I went home, and I really want to speed this up. I got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous by a cousin who was a couple years older than me. Cousin I really looked up to. I thought she was awesome. She was great. She was a really crazy, crazy girl. And she had stolen her first car when she was 12. She got, like, she was dating a bartender when she was, like, 14, you know. And, I mean, it was awesome stuff. And she was really cool. And and my parents recruited her to come and get me and take me to an AA meeting. And she said, I just wanted to let you know that I'm in AA now. And all I knew about AA was they were the people that were always in the basements of the church when I was running for the cops, you know. And I knew they had blue and gold banners, and they had a book. So, you know, it's kind of reminded me of other things I'd been exposed to as a kid. So I'm like, nah, I'm all set with the Jesus juice. I'll stick to drinking and doing my thing. And she's like, no, it's not like that. It's really cool. There's young people. And I'm like, all right, let's, you know, I'll go check this out. Young people, cool. You know, so I went to this meeting. She lied through her teeth. It was like a Teamster hall. It was absolutely unbearable. I had already had my fill of fat old men with gray hair, trust me. And see what happens? And life is funny. And so here I am in an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting at Boston College High School Friday night. The date was July 10th of 1980. That booze cruise that I went on was July 4th. It took me 6 days to walk again. So on the 10th, I went to my first Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I was introduced to a couple of people who asked me my name and said, if you'd like to join the group, we'll sign you up. And I was kind of mocus. That's mind out of focus. And I was totally nutso. And so I signed my name to this thing, and I said, all right, well, so next Friday, I'll have to come back here again. You know, all right, so I'll come back next Friday. They didn't tell me that they had meetings every day. And that some fat old guy with gray hair was going to be showing up at my house every day for the next week at 7 o'clock to say, send the kid out, you know? And so these horrible, horrible, smelly men would show up at my house every... I was 19 years old. I was fat... The week... Well, about a month before this, I was on the catwalk at Studio 54, and now I'm sitting at a Greasy Spoon with Bob the Mailman, Postman Greg, and Four-Fingered Willie, you know? Everyone in AA... have these stupid nicknames, because we can't use last names, so they all have these dumb secret handshake nicknames. You know, Cigar Joe and, like, Trucker Bob, and it was an absolute nightmare. I was horrified. But here I am with, you know, these guys, and they're taking me out to really awful restaurants, well below my station. You know, Greasy Spoons and Denny's. I'd never set foot in a Denny's in my life until AA. I was kept in much higher fashion than that, but these guys didn't have the kind of money that my old friends did. So I went to AA and I went to meetings and I got that hope. I didn't get the hope from young people. There were some young people, a couple, not a lot, 1980, but a couple of young people. But I got the hope from old-timers who hugged me and told me they loved me, even though I really knew that they were terrified of me. They didn't want me in their car. I mean, I look like a normal person today, but trust me, 1980, the ensemble was very different. I was not socially acceptable. I couldn't speak a single sentence without using profanity. And I threw those features about me that other people found objectionable, I threw them at you to keep you away from me so that I didn't have to make you happy. I didn't have to meet your standards. I didn't have to worry about fitting in. I wanted you to hate me right from the beginning so we're on common ground. And that didn't work in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was nasty as fuck. And they loved me anyway. And these guys took me around and they took me to meetings. And I joined that group and I became a member. And that I was at that I shake and baked at my own mom's house. You know, my mom kept me in my what used to be my bedroom, it's now my dad's den, but I was in there, you know, shaking and baking, and the old timers came in and they'd ring my mom's bell and say, "Send the kid out," and I'd go in the car. And they'd go in and they'd tell my mom, you know, give him a lot of ice cream, don't let him use the phone, don't let him leave the house, don't let him have any privacy, take the door off the bedroom. They did. They took the door off my bedroom, so I didn't have a door. They said, don't let him, you know, go through his drawers, do his laundry for him, look through his pockets, don't let him do anything, because he's going to try to get over on you. And they schooled my parents on how to, you know, have a crazy kid in the house. And I detoxed with lots of ice cream and lots of cookies, and, you know, I was given anything I wanted, and I got sober. And I joined an Alcoholics Anonymous group, and that was it. You know, I'm not doing no sponsor, I'm not doing no book, I'm all set with all that stuff. I went to a lot of meetings, and I got a little bit of encouragement at that time, I'll tell you, from a few people that was enough, that was okay. I was lied to, as far as I'm concerned, because what I needed was the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sponsor, and the big book. That's what I needed. I don't lie to people today. I don't sugarcoat anything. So before you ask me to be a sponsor, beware. You know, I eventually did find that man. I found that guy who had nothing in common with me. He was nothing like me. He was a former Jesuit. and he brought me through this book. And, you know, I found out that AA isn't what happens at AA meetings. AA meetings are our public relations. These are our BSAs. AA happens at his kitchen table. And that's what I got. I got his kitchen table. I got this book, and I got his experience as translated through his mouth while reading this book, because this book made no sense to me at all. I don't know what the bone-crushing juggernaut of self-will is, you know what I mean? The language in here was a little old-fashioned, and it got translated through my sponsor, and I was told what my job was, and my job was to eventually get sober, get a new way of life, and then immediately help other people, and that's the only reason why I was doing this. If I was going to help other people, then there was no sense in me getting sober. And I did. I followed that man into a lot of different kinds of meetings. I followed that man through the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I learned a whole new way of living. I learned a whole new way of looking at myself, looking at my selfishness, my very basic nature. And all those things that I blamed everybody for, all those beatings, all that horror, all that being not accepted and growing up feeling different and growing, you know, I blamed that on everything else in the world. And I found out it was alcoholism. It was me. I was separating myself from the world. And I began to work through those things with the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. I did a lot of things in those times. I had a sponsor who told me never say no. I was taught several things. I was not able to be honest. I wasn't able to be enthusiastic. I wasn't able to really grasp a lot of these higher ideas. But I was able to do some simple things, and he told me to sit up front at every meeting, to sit in the front row. So I sat in the front row. He told me don't go outside during the break, and I used to smoke, so that was pretty tough. But he told me don't go outside during the break. The people that need your help are here, and I stayed inside during the break. He told me not to talk during meetings, to not gossip and giddy, giddy, giddy in the back. So I didn't do the kiki in the back with the other people. I stayed in the front row and I paid attention. He told me to thank every speaker, every meeting, even if I hated their guts and I thought they were stupid. He told me to thank them anyway. So I thanked every speaker. And he told me to say yes to every commitment. If you're asked to, you know, I was told the ABCs of Alcoholics Anonymous are ashtrays, brooms, and chairs. So I cleaned ashtrays. You know, I swept up meetings and I set up chairs. And he gave me those basic things that I could do. I could commit to sitting in the front seat. I might not be able to commit to doing, you know, an amends, but I could commit to sitting in the front seat. So I did those things, and those little bits of self-esteem helped me to build up to the other things. So I started doing esteemable things and becoming that person. Eventually I cut my hair and tried out men's clothes, and all kinds of crazy things happened. And it was a pretty amazing transition for me to become one of those children of God that I used to see on the train in the morning when I was coming home at 6 a.m. when the sun came up and you were going to work. I was so ashamed to be me, and now I was becoming one of you. And again, you know, things happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was 9 months sober, and someone asked me if I could be their sponsor. And I told them, no, I can't sponsor you until I have a year, because that's what someone told me. Once again, you get lied to around here every once in a while. And, you know, I said no, but he waited 3 months and asked me again. And so at the magic year point, you know, fairy dust fell from the sky, and I became able to sponsor. And I started sponsoring him, and that's when the magic started to happen for me, because helping others is what I did this for. That's why I did all this. And I started sponsoring other people. Wow, so many things. I sponsored a man. I was a couple years sober, and I was sponsoring this guy and bringing him through the 12 steps, and he relapsed and disappeared. And he came back a year later or so, and he had a wife and a baby and another baby on the way. And he was still using, he was still drinking. And he asked me if I could help him, and I tried to help him. But he wasn't willing to concede that that this was a program that needed some kind of higher power. It was very difficult for him, and he didn't make it. And he continued to use until the DSS came and took, at that time he had his second baby, and they took his kids away. And he was horrified. He was really disturbed that these two kids were in a foster home, and he and his wife were unable to see them even, because they were both drinking and drugging. And he asked me if I would help. And so I was told in Alcoholics Anonymous to say yes. So I went to court with him and went up to the judge. And at that time, I had a good job and a good apartment. And he asked the judge if I could take his kids in as a foster child, foster children. And I took his children in as a foster parent for, it was supposed to be for 6 months. And I thought that this would be a good way to be a service, give him and his wife a chance to recover and get sober, and then come back and take their kids. And they didn't get sober. And my son is now 27 and my daughter is 26. And, so be careful when you listen to your sponsor. And you know, and on the serious side, their mom committed suicide in 1999, and their father hung himself in 2007. And I had to walk both of my kids through their parents' deaths. We had to, and they had nothing else, no one else. It was me and my kids that picked up their bodies and did the cremations and did the services. And it was a painful thing to watch two people that you love go through. But I sat at their dad's bedside. You know, he hung himself, but they revived him, and it took 3 days after they took the plug out for him to pass away. And I sat in that room with both of my children for 3 days, because that man deserved respect. He was an addict. And he was just like us. And no addict did ever have to die alone. And as a responsible, productive member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I could not let that man be in that room by himself. And I stayed there with him. Some other things happened in Alcoholics Anonymous. I had an opportunity many, many times to take a look at what was happening in AA about people dying here. And, I found that a lot of people in this room, in these rooms, especially at young people's conventions, were dying of heroin overdoses. And, you know, it's now a popular thing to talk about. And all of a sudden, it's cool to talk about that. It's kind of a hot topic. But it's been a very personal thing for me for a very long time. And I find that I have to be very, very careful in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we are Alcoholics Anonymous. We have a singleness of purpose. And my job is not to point to someone who's questioning whether they belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, they get out, go there. My best option is to say, all right, well, maybe you do belong here, maybe you don't, but let's go over there and check this out. Come with me. And I would take people to other fellowships if they needed to check it out. I have a responsibility to the whole world, not just Alcoholics Anonymous. When anyone anywhere reaches out for help, I want the hand of AA to be there. It doesn't say when any alcoholic anywhere. It says anyone. And that includes my children. That includes the wives and children of my sponsees. That includes my sponsor. I'm there to help him. I'm there to help strangers on the street. I'm there to help the people that I work with. I have an amazing responsibility. And with all that responsibility comes a lot of sacrifice. And one of the things that I really think is important is when I meet young, new people in Alcoholics Anonymous, I don't lie to them. I tell them, this is going to be the hardest thing you've ever done in your life because you're going to have to give up a lot. I gave up a lot to be here. I was 19 years old. By the way, that sobriety date of July 10th of 1980, it's the only thing I haven't changed. So I gave up a lot to be here because I was young. I was very pretty. I had a very illustrious career as a solid gold dancer. I just had everything. I was going to do all these things, and I had to give those up to become a responsible and productive member of society. You know, I lost the ability to manipulate and lie. I didn't lose the ability. I shouldn't say that. I lost the right to manipulate and lie because I could. I could really sell you just about anything I needed to sell you, and I had lost my ability to do anything that I wanted with my sex powers. I had to really evaluate that little area of my life too. I had to reevaluate my place in my family, you know. Stop blaming everybody for everything else that went on and start taking responsibility for things that I was very uncomfortable with, things I was very ashamed of. Going through the steps over and over again helped me to do that. It helped me to continue to challenge myself, continue to grow, and continue to enlarge my spiritual condition. When I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a very, very staunch agnostic. I used to say atheist, but then I looked it up in the dictionary. I can't say it anymore. But I was a very staunch agnostic. And I found it very, very difficult to justify the kind of things I was being asked to do at Alcoholics Anonymous. Once again, you know, my sponsor sat down and gave me his experience, and I learned a whole new way of looking at things. It was a simple perspective change. That's all it was. Nothing changed other than my own perspective. I came to know that I started to see where religious people were right. I'm painfully aware where they're wrong. That doesn't mean we ignore that. But I look to see where people are right. I look for the good in people. I look for the positive as much as I can. And I found a lot. And I found myself raising two children, wanting them to have some of the things, because there were some pretty cool things about growing up in the religion that I grew up in. I thought there was some things about it that were pretty cool. And I wanted my kids to have something like that without all the drama and nonsense. And I was like, all right, well, let me look around. I poked around a few churches, and I found, you know, a denomination of church that was pretty cool, kind of hippie, kind of cool, you know, pretty queer friendly and all that and stuff. And brought my kids there, and I dropped them off at the RV classes so they can have something. And then I'd go to Dunkin' Donuts for an hour. Because I ain't going to church. And so I did that for about a couple of months or so, and Dunkin' Donuts gets to you after a while. So I said, all right, how bad can it be? I'll sit in the back, I'll take a nap, you know. And I walked into a religious group and sat in the back, and found out that this was not the church of my childhood. This was a very different kind of community. It was an awful lot like Alcoholics Anonymous, to be perfectly honest with you. And I found myself really reveling in all those things that I remembered from my childhood that were good, and just like letting go of all the things that I didn't want. And it was actually pretty cool. And so I joined that church, and I became a member. I started getting active, and I was a lot of things when I drank. I had a lot of names. I was a liar, a thief. I was a whore. I was a horrible person.